I'm going to discuss some organizational tools with you in debate, and I'll make about four major statements. The first has to do with filing. When we produce research as we're reading secondary sources in order to make arguments which we might want to produce in a debate, it's important that you file the material as you research it. In other words, you will only know that you're near completion of a research agenda if, in the process of filing it, you begin to see redundancies or you begin to see holes which will then restructure whatever research you want to engage in. In addition to filing information as you research, even if it's in a series of little envelopes or if it's in an expando file or anything like that, you also might want to start briefing as you file. Now, we talk about briefs in a separate lecture, but what you want to do is take the material that's like other material and try to determine where it would appear in the argument and brief it as you file it. Presumably, in the process of doing that, you will get to a point where you have enough good quality research to actually sit down and write the shell of the argument, which is that first basic brief you want to write. But you want to brief as you file. Granted, the briefs you produce when you file are probably not going to be the final briefs. I often refer to them as pre-briefs. They will eventually make themselves into final briefs, but you won't only know that if you brief as you file. You don't want to just gather a large quantity of information and then try to file all the quantity of information, then to see days down the line that you do not have the material you need for the argument you wanted to write. So the first basic organizational tool of debate that's important is filing. File the material. The second major consideration is roadmaps. When we are giving a debate speech, we need to understand our audience is going to try to recall that one way or another. That having been said, we need to have a basic organizational scheme in the speech. We need to be able to tell the audience and critic as we are speaking where we are in the debate. We need to treat it as a visual image. This often includes a whole series of cues. And so we have the speech organized. We often use these as possible cues. First, in speech, when we get to an argument, we present a thesis of the argument, a synopsis, a sentence or two, which basically describe the subject of the argument and why the argument may be important. Within the argument, we will tag all of the sub-arguments. We will tag each of the elements in the argument that we need to stress. All a tag is, again, is a synopsis of a sub-thesis that's found within the argument. Finally, we'll number them. We will number the arguments, the sub-arguments within our grand argument, and we will number the arguments themselves in order to make it easier for the audience to recall the information. It all comes down to the organization of the speech. No matter how good you are speaking, no matter how strong your arguments are, if your audience does not see them organized and cannot comprehend where you are in the debate, they are unlikely to be able to record the debate and make a viable decision or even a decision in your favor. The third thing I need to mention is how we try to record a debate. And it's a rather challenging thing to do in a video. But I can make one basic observation. When I'm teaching in the classroom, one of the first things I do, at least in the basic debate class, is I begin to tell students that, you know, they've always been taught to take notes wrongly. In other words, when we try to take notes and we try to record information as students, what we tend to do is take a single piece of paper, often with lines written on it, and we start at the top of the page and we just write everything that's happening as we go down the page. And we end up having something which basically goes from left to right, continual text. And even though that's fine if we happen to be writing in a journal, it doesn't provide a useful way of taking notes in an academic setting. I often tell my students to take a piece of paper that they want to take notes and draw a line down the middle of the paper. And on the left-hand side, take the notes from the lecture. On the right-hand side, leave enough space where you can write questions or when you're reviewing the notes for a midterm or a final to put questions or put down areas you need specific clarification. That way you have usable notes. Now, debate also requires you to be fairly creative when you're taking notes, because debate is an incredibly linear process. What happens in a debate round is we will have a speech It will be the first speech of the debate, which will be followed by a second speech, followed by a third speech, followed by a fourth speech, and presumably the debaters will be discussing the same matter across the debate. Now, the term we use for how we record a debate is the word flowchart, which is a term we borrow from computer programming. And you've seen flowcharts where they use a series of symbols in order to connect commands that we would have in a program. In a standard debate round, we might use something like this. If you can see this reasonably clearly, we start at this end where we have a speaker making an argument. We then have the next speaker presenting his or her responses. The third speaker presenting his or her responses in response to this speech, et cetera, all the way down. So we start with, at least in policy debate where we have eight speeches, we have the first affirmative constructive here, and then you would have, if you realize, about seven columns going this way. In a Lincoln-Douglas debate where we have five speeches being given, we would have the first speech here, which would be the affirmative constructive, and then we would have five columns going across where you could record the debate. So the debate flows across these pieces of paper we record on. And using a flow chart like that, we get a visual cue of how the debate is going. We see the quality of the responses based upon the empty spaces that appear in this construction. This is called flow charting. It visually punctuates what's going on in the debate round. I often have told my students to choose blank pieces of paper and ones without lines because they're going to violate all the lines they find on a piece of paper. 8.5 by 14 paper tends to work very well in policy debates. 8.5 by 11 is quite fine in a Lincoln-Douglas debate. If it has lines, draw lines against the lines if you need to in order to break it into a usable flowchart. The power of flowcharting is it not only visually punctuates what's going on in the debate as a debater when you look at the flow, but in addition, it provides a way when you're making arguments to review the flow and see how the arguments are progressing through the debate. And you can visually punctuate what's happening in the debate by actually taking this piece of paper, whether it's a piece of paper that is flimsy as this piece would be, or one with a harder stock, and you can punctuate the debate by setting it aside and then move to another piece of paper, which is the key to actually being effective as a flowcharter in a debate round. If you want to learn how to flow debates and load flow debates well, use lots of paper. I mean, always provide each argument with its own piece of paper. This allows you to be able to shuffle the paper appropriately and to go to arguments in whatever order you find is better for a given debate round. So you're visually punctuating the debate by reordering the debate. You're also visually punctuating the debate by setting the flows aside as you move on from one argument to another, giving a visual cue to the critic and audience in the debate. The final thing I need to mention in terms of organizational tools deals with how one transports all this material around. Because as you begin to debate, you'll discover that some of the material research on a debate topic might be relevant in the subsequent year as well and this year after that. And so you end up gathering an incredible quantity of information. Programs which have been around for many years tend to maintain master files as well. You often see debaters going to tournaments with large quantities of paper information, often stored in tubs or cartons, which they then carry with them into rounds for competition. While in parliamentary debates, we do not have evidence read in the debate round, but referred to, in policy debates and Lincoln-Douglas debates, we often have material read into the debate from files. I recommend that material you use be put in expanding files. Expanding files often are numbered 1 through 33 or A through Z. And you can change those designations and put material in expanding files that you use with some degree of regularity. Also, in order to transport the information, I mean, there are high-end expensive tubs made by Rubbermaid and such, which are sealed and easily locked and waterproof. But for those on a more restrictive budget, you can simply go to your local produce store and get the cartons which are used for produce, especially for fruit, and they are pretty much the right size for large quantities of 8.5 by 11 paper and 8.5 by 11 folders. In terms of organizational tools then, File your material and file it regularly. In the speeches, you need to roadmap the speeches so the audience and critic know where you are. You are debating to be recorded. Learn to flowchart. Practice flowing debate rounds when you're not in a debate round. If an elimination round is occurring and you aren't in that round, but you're free, flow it. Learn to flow and learn to flow well. It's one of the skills that is most difficult to teach, but without it, you won't be able to really focus on making the sufficient number and correct responses to arguments. In terms of the materials, carry them with you. Expanding files in tubs, in cartons, whatever's convenient and whatever works for you. Thank you.
I am here to discuss the idea of building a case. And to begin with, let's talk about the nature of a proposition and the way in which a case is introduced in a debate. When one debates, there is a given motion or proposition for debate. And one side of the debate, labeled the affirmative side or the government side, supports that proposition, and the negative side or the opposition team in the debate undermines the government or affirmative claim for the proposition. And when the government or the affirmative side advances their agenda in the debate, they do so as a case. And a case is simply a logical proof of a proposition. That's it. It is a logical proof of a proposition. There are many ways in which an individual or a team might present a logical proof, and I want to give some comments about the most popular example in a moment, but let me just note that one could have a deductive analysis of factual information. It's possible to present a logical proof through a chronological investigation of historical events. One could have a critical examination of a cause and effect relationship. But the most popular version of a case in virtually all forms of debate is to argue a problem and a solution, to identify a problem that exists and propose as a hypothetical a solution to that problem. That kind of presentation can explore factual matter, it can make value claims, it can argue in favor of a good, and it can also support the notion of a policy, a specific course of action that might be recommended as a matter of change. Now, there are some advantages associated with presenting as a case, a logical proof that operates in a problem-solution framework. It clarifies issues quite cleanly in a debate. It sets up a discrete and identifiable area of need and then identifies a specific solution for that problem. And so it brings great clarity and focus to a debate. It also narrows the possibilities for one's opponent in a debate. Because the opponent must now debate the specific elements of a particular policy which would be the solution to a problem, it really directs the opposition's arguments as much as it does the focus of the debate. In other words, the opposition side, the negative team in the debate, is called upon to address the details of a particular solution to a problem rather than to have a general and more abstract discussion about the nature of a topic. And so there are some distinct advantages to a problem-solution framework. Now, what are the elements of this kind of case? Well, I think we've identified the key elements. One has to have a problem, and then one has to have a solution to the problem. These, by the way, are also referred to as stock issues in a debate. Most things that are described as the stock issues of a debate are unnecessarily complex. In most debates, what constitutes stock issues are the framework of a logical proof And in this context, that means identify a problem and come up with a solution for it. Now, what does it mean, though, to have a problem? Well, there are two elements associated with a problem. First, it has to be a serious matter. It has to be a serious matter. If it isn't a serious matter, it isn't a problem. If someone passes you by on the street and hands you thousands of dollars or thousands of pounds, this isn't a problem for you. It's not a serious matter that one would have to address because of the negative implications in one's life. It actually would be a great benefit to you. And so it has to be a serious matter of concern to an individual or perhaps a group or society. In addition, it has to be an ongoing problem. It has to be an ongoing problem. If the problem's resolved, then it's no longer a problem for an individual. There are technical terms in policy debating in the United States for these issues. When one identifies whether or not a problem is a serious matter, this is an issue of significance, an issue of significance. And by significance, we're simply talking about the qualitative and quantitative dimensions of a problem. Does it matter a lot? Does it matter to a lot of people? That's the issue of significance. And is it an ongoing problem? Is it a contemporary one? This is the issue of inherency, and this simply describes that a problem is continuing and demands a solution. And what do we need for a solution to a problem? Well, we need one that is technically available and is workable. This is, by the way, referred to with the term solvency in policy debating. And really, we're just talking about whether or not we have a technically feasible and workable solution to a problem. After all, we could resolve problems with our psychic power or with magic, and this would be the solution to all of our problems. But what we're really looking for are practical solutions to problems, and those are the elements associated with a logical proof. Got to have a problem that is a serious matter and ongoing. Got to have a solution that is technically feasible. The solution is expressed in two related ways. One is a plan, a policy, a course of action that is a solution, and then arguments that would support an explanation as to why that particular solution would resolve the problem. And so both a framework for a solution and the argument supporting that particular framework. There's a process for building a case as well, and let me discuss the three elements associated with the process of building the case. First, argument anticipation. Argument anticipation. It's necessary to anticipate the moves that an opponent's side will make in a debate, as well as the moves that one would make as a speaker or a team in a debate. Debates like any other game, playing cards, board games, Mensa puzzles, the athletic events. Like all games, debate relies on the successful anticipation of the moves of opponent and then ways in which one might block those moves or take lateral intellectual movements or superior intellectual movements in order to succeed in a contest that is an academic and intellectual one. And so argument anticipation, the ability to foretell what will happen in a debate, is necessary in the construction of a case. It serves as the foundation for proof. It allows you to analyze what the opposition might do in a debate, and also lets you know which arguments must be maintained in order to sustain one's proof in a debate. One needs to engage in preparation In order to build a successful case, this means both basic and applied research. You should have a little bit of information about the background associated with a topic area, as well as specific information about a particular course of action, a plan or policy that one might introduce. And one also needs to have a goal associated with the construction of an argument, and that is when one wants to have a policy change, one would advocate a small change to produce a large benefit. There's a particular design associated with the case. It works well in virtually all contexts, and that is simply a narrative presentation that is both simple to understand and yet has sophisticated reasoning. This will allow it to appeal to all kinds of audiences. And the narrative presentation, have an introduction, have a body that expresses the logical proof, and provide a powerful conclusion. A presentation should have persuasive elements as well as reasoning elements. And this is the way in which one can logically design a case. Get everyone's attention, tell them why the issue is important, frame it in a problem-solution manner, and then give a conclusion that will resonate with the audience.
One specific context is refutation. And we're talking about organization, and I just want to mention a few organizational guidelines that you should keep in mind when you're refuting the arguments of an opposing advocate. The first one is you need to make sure to identify the opposing argument that you're answering. You need to make sure that the audience is on the same page as you are. What argument specifically is it that you're answering? Generally, studies show that the more specific you are in identifying the argument you're answering, then the more seriously they take your refutation of it. Second, you want to make sure to refute specific arguments. You want to make sure to answer and critically analyze specifically what is being said by the opposing advocate. Don't commit the fallacy of reconstruing it or making their argument into something else, something that perhaps is easier for you to answer. Refute a specific argument and mention with specificity what that argument is. Third, make sure that you group opposing arguments when they're similar. If they keep saying the same thing over and over again in many different ways, don't try to answer them individually. Group them all together. Mention to the audience, for example, that there are certain arguments that have the same theme or the same substance that your opponents are using, and then you can group all those arguments together and give them a convincing, detailed, and comprehensive answer, especially if that answer relates to a similar theme or a facet that they have. You'll get into much more depth and detail, and you'll be much more effective if you do this than if you try to answer each of them separately. Fourth, make sure to be able to use arguments against your opponents. Use their arguments against them whenever you can. When you are simply refuting or answering their argument, you're sort of on the defensive. And that's fine. You want to do that. You want to answer their arguments. You want to critically analyze their arguments. But if there's ever a situation where you can use their arguments against them, then you certainly should do that. Some of the situations in which that happens are as follows. For example, sometimes people will be very demanding in terms of their standards for your proof and the kind of arguments and evidence that you should present. Make sure that the standards that they present are also applied to their arguments, towards their forms of proof. If they demand that your claims be supported by empirical evidence or expert opinion, then you should be able to apply that argument to them. Make sure that their ideas are supported by empirical evidence or expert opinion. You should also apply their arguments to their own ideas and positions to reveal contradictions when there are contradictions of fact, contradictions of evidence, contradictions of result, contradictions of causality, various
things that they prove at one point in one direction are proven in another direction at another point in the discussion, you need to point that out. If they have contradictory values, for example, at one point they're saying that economic well-being is the most important factor, and then at another point they're saying that, you know, ecological concern is the most important factor. Well, which is it? Not both can be the most important factor. At other points, you may find that advocates are saying that the government should not intervene in the economic marketplace. And then at other points, they will be calling for government intervention in the economic marketplace. It's clear that audiences find instances where you reveal the contradictions in your opponent's positions to be very, very effective. So, while organizing yourself while you're refuting an argument, name the argument that you're refuting. Refute it specifically. Group things together if they say the same thing, and whenever possible, use people's arguments against them, and your refutation will be effective and fairly well organized.
I'm here to discuss the issue of issue selection in a debate. How does one determine which arguments to advance and which arguments to ignore in a debate? And I think at the outset, what I'd like to do is just discuss the nature of debate for a moment. Most people believe that debate is about the automatic gainsaying of an opponent's position. An affirmative or proposition team argues in favor of a motion, and the opposition or negative team simply argues against the motion. And whatever the team in favor or individual in favor of the motion argues, the other side simply disputes those claims. And there's certainly an element associated with that. No one would say the debate ignores issues of challenge, conflict, disputation. Debate is about disagreement. And at the outset, I just want to note four measures that one can use as a foundation for disagreement in a debate. One could disagree based on issues of relevance, minimization, capture, and answer. Relevance, minimization, capture, and answer. And let's go through these with a small amount of detail. The issue of relevance. One can refute an argument presented by another side in the debate by simply arguing that the subject matter is not relevant to the discussion. Subject matter is not relevant to the discussion. And because the subject matter is not relevant to the discussion, there is no reason for it to be included. In other words, the opposing side's argument is not meaningful, not germane, and so should be excluded from consideration by an audience or a judge. Secondly, one might minimize an opponent's argument in a debate. One might minimize an opponent's argument in a debate. This would reduce to relative insignificance an opponent's idea. There are many issues that are presented in a debate. Some of them are meaningful, some of them are trivial, and it's necessary to identify how one's core arguments are more meaningful and how one's opponent's arguments are more trivial or diminished in status. One might also, in a third technique, capture the opponent's argument. This is often referred to as a turn of an opponent's argument. In this case, one is technically arguing that an idea introduced by another side in the debate actually offers better support for one's own side of the motion or plan of action or argumentation than it does for theirs. These three types of refutation are valuable techniques for issue selection emphasis in a debate, and the reason why, they are efficient models of argumentation. And the reason that they are efficient is they do not require an individual to construct a full argument in order to answer a position in the debate. In many ways, they simply accept the argument that's been advanced from another side and manipulate the circumstances of a debate so that they do not have to fully develop argumentation to counter that kind of issue. With relevance, one says, I don't care if your argument is a powerful one, it's not meaningful for the debate. With minimization, one argues, I'm not concerned about the value of your argument. It seems relatively trivial to the outcome of this contest. With capture or turning an argument, a debater might say, I'm not going to dispute the claim that you've introduced in the debate. It actually supports my case better than it does your own. Only if one can't engage in these efficient forms of argumentation should one then answer, dispute, challenge an opponent's position that they've advanced in a debate. And so I think that the first principle of issue selection is efficiency. But debate's not just about disagreement, debate's also about strategic agreement. Strategic agreement. In order to clarify issues in a debate, sometimes to advance one's own interests in a debate, or to focus on more important issues, it's necessary for debaters to agree about some of the issues that have been introduced in a debate. And so the second selection criterion might be clarity, advancing one's own interests by getting the other side to agree about an important principle. We, I think, would recognize that not all issues in a debate are equal. We have to discern the meaningful ideas from the trivial ideas. And so the third criterion for selection of issues in a debate is outcome assessment. How is an individual ultimately going to play out in a debate contest? The reason that this is important is debate's not about truth seeking. It is not about finding the correct answer to a problem. Debates are too short. There are too many ideas that are advanced, and many of the issues that are argued in debate are played out in public policy arenas and philosophical discussions for decades or even centuries. And so it is unlikely that one will find the truth about whether or not liberty is more important than equality in a 7 or 8 minute speech. And if you can, perhaps you shouldn't be involved in debate, but should be making your mark on the world. Debate's not really about truth seeking. It's really about advantage seeking. One is trying to identify a relative position to their opponent in the debate, simply to argue that in this particular circumstance, I have a better expression of opinion on this matter than my opponent. And so one is always trying to discern the meaningful from the trivial relative to one's opponent. And the way to do that is through outcome assessment. Why do your arguments matter when compared with your opponent's arguments? Let's take an example in which we might discern the meaningful from the trivial and then talk about principles associated with it. The example might be argumentation on the death penalty. And one might be placed in a position to argue or choose to argue in favor of the death penalty in a given debate. And in order to argue in favor of the death penalty, one might advance these ideas. The death penalty deters individuals from committing heinous crimes. The way in which it does, there's a direct deterrent. If individuals are executed, they are unable to continue to engage in violent acts against other individuals. They also might have a general deterrent effect. Individuals might fear the application of the death penalty, and so they might be unlikely to commit the kinds of crimes for which one is charged with a capital defense, with a capital offense, and subject to the death penalty. One might argue that the death penalty is necessary for social retribution, that it's an important concept for a justice system to have an element that is extraordinary to deal with extraordinary crimes. One might argue that the death penalty is necessary to deal with leaders of nations or individuals engaged in crimes against humanity, that for a genocidal act, there is no other punishment that will satisfy valued principle such as justice. And one might also argue that executing individuals saves hundreds or thousands of dollars in care for the incarcerated. Well, I think we can recognize that one might logically argue all of these issues in a debate, but if the death penalty deters individuals from committing crime or meets our expectations of a justice system or deals successfully with issues associated with crimes against humanity, who really then cares whether or not it's going to save a few dollars? In fact, the idea that we are putting people to death and then claiming, well, this might be a way in which we could generate more social welfare or profit a bit, seems rather trivial and mean-spirited. And so one might eliminate that particular argument and focus on the first three, deterrence, retribution, and a necessary punishment for crimes against humanity. How would one make that kind of decision? Well, I think there are two important principles. The first is significance. You need to identify qualitative and quantitative values associated with arguments in a debate. Why does it matter? How much does it matter? And to whom does it matter? And issues in a debate ought to matter a lot and to a lot of people. In addition, one needs to have perspective on an issue in a debate. When one supports the motion or supports the topic in the debate, the arguments that they select should support a logical proof for that topic and should be the issues that are critical to an explanation of that topic. And the arguments from the opposing side in the debate should undermine that proof. Each issue presented by either side in the debate should have the elements of significance so that any single argument might overwhelm the totality of arguments from the other side. In that way, you only need to win a single major argument to win a debate. At the same time, all the arguments that one might select to advance in a debate, and certainly would select in a rebuttal speech in a debate to summarize the final stand on the floor for either side of the motion, ought to indicate to a judge or audience how one has a relative advantage in the debate, and that means that they have to establish the important principle of significance and issue perspective in order to reach that conclusion.
Let's conclude our discussion with organization for the debater by talking about summaries and how to weigh issues. These are things that occur at the end of speeches and at the end of debates, and they're essential components of a good debate performance. Let's talk about summaries. So often summaries are just a review of what has been said. We said this, we said this, we said that. Of course, that's fine for reminding people of what you said, but hopefully they don't need to be reminded of what your major issues are. So really, summaries need to do a lot more than that. Of course, you can't just start doing these sorts of things during your summary. You have to pave the way. You need to have internal summaries throughout your presentations, earlier in the speech and earlier in the debate. You need to say that particular ideas or issues are extremely important, that certain things, although interesting, are largely irrelevant. These are the kinds of comparative evaluative things you need to have inside of your speeches during a debate. But when it comes to the summary, I think there are three specific things that you want to do. The first is you want to review what the major arguments are in the debate. What are the issues? And when you do that, I think you want to do the second thing that's important for a summary, and that is weigh those issues. Explain why yours is more important than theirs. Even if you give some credence to their argument, yours will be more meaningful, more important, and more compelling. You want to weigh the issues. Don't just always assume that the audience thinks that everything your opponent said is false and everything you say is true. That's not the reality of the situation. Probably the audience believes that both sides in a debate have some good points to make. You just have to convince them that your points are more important than the points of your opponents. The third thing you want to do in your summary is have some kind of concluding effect, some kind of end to your presentation. It could either be a dramatic statement of advocacy. It could be a reminder of something particularly important you have said. It could be a simple example or a narrative, something to enhance the emotional effect of your argument or the way people remember your argument. Of the three, I would say that weighing is probably the most important. You need to weigh the issues. As I indicated, in most debates, each side has some good points. The skill is to persuade people that your points are more important, more salient, and more relevant. You do this by weighing. You look for which of the following standards I'm about to talk about favors your comparison. You don't just weigh by saying, mine is important. My ideas are meaningful and important. It has to be a comparative process. You have to indicate that at best, the arguments and the issues that they are likely to have some credibility on are less important than the ideas or issues that you are likely to have some credibility on. I want to suggest 8 different ways that you can look to try to indicate to audiences that your ideas, your concepts are more important than those of your opponents. Some of these are fairly simple. Some of them are somewhat complex, but I think it's a good checklist to keep in mind. And as you look at issues, you can say, well, given this checklist, I can use this one to make mine sound more important, and then you would do that. Here are the 8. Number 1, quantity. Quantity. You can argue that yours is more important because it happens more often, because it affects more persons, that its numerical evaluation is important. That one's pretty simple. Second, qualitatively. Qualitatively. You can argue that yours is more important because each instance of it is qualitatively more important. Losing your arm is more important than losing your finger. Losing your life is more important than losing your foot. So when you're comparing things that are different, you would indicate that the quality or the value of yours is more important. You could lose 10 fingernails before you'd be willing to lose even one finger. And that's just a simple example of how you would say something is more important qualitatively. Third, probability. Probability. This is especially important when you're talking about future events. You can say that the thing that I'm talking about is more probable to happen. It's more likely to happen. We should be more concerned about the more probable things than the less probable things. Especially if theirs seems large but outlandish and not likely to happen, probability is a good measure. Fourth, time frame. Time frame. You can indicate that what you're talking about happens sooner. It comes first. I think there's a couple of simple reasons why you can argue that things that happen sooner are more important than things that happen later. The first is the whole issue of future discounting. We know more about the immediate future than we do about the distant future. If you look at the weather forecast, it's somewhat accurate for tomorrow, but probably not very accurate for a month from now or 3 months from now. As the events get farther away in the future, there's much less certainty about them. So time frame would be important because we could be more certain of things that happen sooner. The second reason why time frame would be important is because when things happen, other things change. The events that come first may very well change the overall dynamic and show that later events, the ones that happen later, either do not happen or are not relevant. A couple of reasons why time frame is important. The fifth standard you can use is one of reversibility. One of reversibility. If a specific event is irreversible, if it happens and it can't be fixed, then it's probably more important. If you have a stroke, for example, it usually impairs some of your physical ability. Irreversible effects of a brain aneurysm would be very important because you can't fix them. On the other hand, if you lose your job, it's certainly bad, but you might get another job. It's not irreversible. Those things that are reversible are less important than those things that are irreversible. This is often true for ecological phenomena. For example, once the Amazon rainforest is gone, it's gone. We can't plant a new one. We can't make a new one. Once the atmospheric balance of the planet has been shifted by global warming, it's not like we can open up the valves of some tanks and change the atmosphere again. It's irreversible. Six, obligations to future generations. Obligations to future generations. Many times, you can appeal to an audience that something is more important because of the impact it will have on their children or their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren. Many people seem concerned about those who will come after them. And I think you can indicate that we have an obligation not to take short-term risks when it would hurt the long-term interests of future generations of humans on this planet. Seventh, I think there's the factor of voluntary versus involuntary risks. When you're comparing things, those risks that are involuntary are much more heinous than those risks that are involuntary. For example, when you smoke cigarettes, that's a voluntary risk. You decide to do that. You decide to take that risk. It can be argued that it's your right to do so. On the other hand, when you smoke indoors or in a crowded room, you exhale the smoke, and so other people also breathe the smoke. Secondhand smoke can be thought of as an involuntary risk. People may experience health effects, damages that they are not consenting to. So voluntary risks are much more tolerable than involuntary risks. And if you're trying to compare two different sets of risks, you should always look for that distinction. Eighth and finally, I think it can be argued that some things are simply morally required. Most of these seven talk about the utilitarian calculus, the greatest benefit for the largest number of people. But that isn't always how we make our decisions. Many times we make decisions based on moral requiredness, not on outcomes. We may decide that slavery would be profitable, would be beneficial for us, but we will not cooperate with it and we will not tolerate it because it is simply morally wrong. We may decide, for example, in some instances, that a violent act is necessary for some tangible benefit, let's say some military action. Or you could argue that violence is never justified by any sort of outcome because it is morally wrong. One of the things to be careful, though, with when you're making this argument is that the audience you're working with shares the same conception of moral obligation that you do, and speaking to audiences of different cultures could be a problem. But people often do make decisions based on morals, and you can decide that something is more important than something else because it's morally required. So, use summaries, review, and weigh the issues. And when you weigh those issues, use these eight logical tools that will help you to do so effectively, and you'll be a very organized and successful debater. All right.